The Masterclass podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Bunurong people. We recognise First Nations people as the original owners and custodians of the lands and waterways across the Australian continent. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
He said, always get the name of the dog, the brand of the beer, and the title of the song that was playing as the car crashed off the road.
I've had editors who've taken out what I thought was my best phrase or my favourite parts, and I've been really annoyed. And then it's often sometimes taken years for me to go, actually, you know, the restraint has made it stronger.
I'm not the guy out there writing stuff that's going to spark a royal commission. I'm just trying to get your attention for 35 minutes on a Saturday morning by reading something that you really enjoy. I'm Conrad Marshall, senior writer for Good Weekend, and today I'm going to give you a masterclass on the craft of feature writing.
Hello and welcome to season 3 of the Masterclass podcast. I'm Louisa Lim, and I teach audio journalism and podcasting at the University of Melbourne. Every episode, I'm speaking to a master of journalism to talk about one aspect of their work. Today, we're hearing from Conrad Marshall, an author and journalist who's written a lot of feature stories for The Good Weekend and other publications. He's twice been named the Melbourne Press Club Harry Gordon Australian Sports Journalist of the Year. Conrad, let's just start with the beginning of a feature. I mean, the lead is, you know, it's the shop window. How do you go about crafting the first line of your feature?
I think, like, all writers have sort of crutches that they lean on. And if I look back at the stories that I've written, mine is obviously the sort of in-person colour anecdotal lead. So I generally like to interview my subjects in places that are meaningful to them, where they're kind of moving through their world and interacting with others. And when I'm doing that, I'm sketching down all of those details so that I can then kind of recreate that moment. A little bit like a cinematographer, I guess. I start describing the bloody clouds and the flowers and the noises all around me. And as I'm doing that and interviewing them, I'm listening in keenly for a quote that sort of sums up why we want to talk to this person or why they might be interesting, or that poses a question about them. And that usually kind of caps off that introduction. So intros for a Good Weekend story, these stories are often 5,000 words. So an intro might be 500, which is the kind of the length of a regular news story. So yeah, throughout that 500 words, I like to just build this sense of scene, get a really heavy descriptive nut graph into there. Those key sentences that make a promise to the reader about what you're going to deliver for the remainder of the story and really sort of convince them why they should read on. And then I like to kind of cap that off with some really great kind of quote that makes people bridge the gap and keep on plowing through.
The process that you're describing, I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about it because you can really see it in some of the stories. And one in particular that I'm thinking about is the profile you did of the filmmaker Taika Waititi. Maybe you could just read that lead out.
Sure. The good news, Taika Waititi is still alive. I wasn't sure. The screen we were speaking through jolted savagely a few minutes ago with a cacophonous bang and a confused yelp, then radio silence. Now the Kiwi filmmaker is back, grinning like a loon. I just broke the fucking table, bro.
But I mean, you know, it's a lovely start, but when I think about it, it's just a Zoom call that went wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's making, you know, lemonade out of lemons. That was a bit of a nightmare assignment in a way, because I have wanted to profile Taika for a long time and reached out to studios every single time he had a new film coming out to see if they could grant me that all-important access that we crave. You know, we like to spend 2 days with subjects or more writing these stories often. At the very minimum, we need a good, like, long 90-minute sit-down interview. And it just couldn't quite come off. And the day that this was supposed to happen, I was in transit. I was doing another job in Brisbane, so I was stuck in this hotel room late at night. I hadn't eaten. He was in London. We were meant to get this promised hour or more if we, you know, if we vibed well. And then it just all kind of went to crap. The PRs got involved and they're like, you're asking too many personal questions. Can we steer this back to the movie at hand or his filmmaking, which was a nightmare in itself because it was still during the writer's strike and he couldn't discuss half of the movie. So I was like, what are we even going to talk about? And then in the middle of it, there was just this stupid calamity where the screen went blank because he accidentally kicked a weird old antique colonial table and knocked the laptop and the ring light off. And I just, in the absurdity of all of that, I figured that sort of has to be the lead because I'm not going to get any time walking around the studio watching Taika film and work with his crew. All I'm going to get is this interaction with him. But he's a guy that's so beloved and fascinating to so many people that even just having a 40-minute Zoom conversation with him is a really lucky and fortunate thing.
There's such a lesson in that for student journalists because, you know, we always like to think that conditions will be perfect, but they never are they? You know, even when you're at the top of your game, things go wrong all the time.
Totally. And at Good Weekend, we often do write-arounds. So for those who don't know, that just means a story where you don't get access to the subject and you have to interview people around them and kind of write through them. And we do those at Good Weekend primarily when somebody says, when they refuse to be interviewed. And usually because there's something, I don't know, a little bit negative about them. So you do a write-around about Gina Rinehart. You do a write-around about Greg Norman. But what I've come to realize and probably realized through this Taika piece, because I only got that really small amount of time with him, this in effect became a write-around too. You can do write-arounds about people you love, people that you think are great, who don't want to talk to you or don't have time to talk to you for much more than a few minutes. In fact, there was a really great story in the New Yorker recently about the world's greatest basketball player, Nikola Jokic. And that was entirely a write-around. It was like 5,000 words about this lovely guy without speaking to the person. And you can manufacture something good if you work hard enough and find all the right voices and pieces of the puzzle.
But coming back to the interview that you did do with Taika Waititi, you had 40 minutes of material. How did you decide what quote to use and how to use it? And I think we have a little section of the interview from the podcast version, which maybe we'll play and then you can talk about how you used what he said.
You don't practice any religion, but you have said that you are spiritual. How does that manifest in daily life?
Oh, it doesn't manifest at all. It's just that I believe that there's, you know, I believe in the spirit world. I believe in that, you know, I believe in, you know, things. I mean, the universe is a word that everyone bandies around quite a lot nowadays, but, you know, I do believe in like the kind of connective tissue of the universe and the energy that scientifically we are made up of a bunch of atoms that are bouncing around off each other. Some of the atoms are just squished together a bit tighter than others, but we're all made of the same stardust. And then that's pretty special.
So that quote about atoms bouncing off each other, being made of the same stardust, did you hear him say that and think, there it is, I'm going to use that?
Oh, yeah. No, I knew. And you almost have to sort of hide that on your face because you want to sort of punch the air a little bit. Like, what a great line. Like, for this guy, like, to describe him and his sense of creativity and genius and madness, it was just ideal. So, yeah, I don't need to write anything down. Like, I don't need to put an asterisk in my notebook. Remember that quote. You just know that later you'll be using it in the story for sure.
And what's your normal process? Do you transcribe your interviews and read them through, or are you just relying on those golden moments?
No, I wouldn't recommend my process to anyone because it's pretty laborious, but I do transcribe every single interview and I transcribe them all in full because It's not that I don't trust Otter or Dragon Dictation or any of the other programs that will transcribe for you automatically, but I just find that it allows the information to seep in again. Like, you're listening to it all again. I don't think you're really picking up anything new. It's all sinking in more deeply, and that kind of helps inform you when you sit down to write. So I transcribe everything, all of the interviews that I've done. I sketch out all of the little bits of colour that I was describing before. I try to build up little written pictures of scenes that I might use in, say, an introduction or after a section break. I mean, as I type out quotes, I might think that's going to be a great one to end on if I feel like ending on a quote, and I'll put in capital letters up above it. Ender with a question mark. Intro with a question mark. And I start labelling all of those quotes and all of that colour with different sort of headers around sections of the story that I might want to then group them all into later after I've talked to all sorts of other voices. And what I then end up with is this horrendous kind of unwieldy Word document that's like anywhere between 50 and 100 pages that somehow I have to kind of break down and order and squish into a 4,000, 5,000 word story.
50 to 100 pages for a single article?
Yeah, easily.
Okay, that is laborious.
I mean, it really is, but it's just my process. Like, once I've cranked it all out into that Word document, I spend like a day or so reading through it and just polishing it up and kind of deleting things that I know are not going to make it. So right now I'm working on a feature story about a radio host, and it's at about 60 pages. And when we're finished talking today, I'll spend all day and a lot of tonight reading through it. And hopefully by tomorrow morning, it'll be closer to 30 pages. And in my mind, I'll know that a 4,000 or 5,000 word story is probably going to be 8 pages. So I'll start reordering, and I kind of edit my way to the finish in a way.
But at what point does the kind of nub of the story become clear? Do you go out with the idea, or does it change in the reporting process?
I guess sometimes you can see it in advance, and sometimes it just emerges when you're doing it. So Taika Waititi, I had no idea what the structure of that was going to be like until I'd conducted the interview and then done a bunch of other interviews around him, and there was a lot of sort of thought that had to go into that because I couldn't see the through line. But with other stories, I think I sent one through about the Noongars, who they're an Indigenous nation in Western Australia. They just happen to be very, very good at football and overrepresented in it. Before I set out to do that story, I knew exactly where the story was going to start. Like, it was going to start at footy training on a Thursday night with a Noongar football team in the northern suburbs of Perth. And that would kick off this detective story to find out why these guys are so good at football. And yeah, sometimes it just seems obvious and logical, and other times it's really difficult to find the way.
I mean, with that story, there was a lot of Noongar history that you had to go into. How seriously do you take that whole research process?
Well, I think with something like that, and we don't always get this luxury anymore, but that was about 7 years ago, and I was able to just fly over to Perth. I knew that I had a week there, and I would ask every question I could possibly think of each individual. The last question that I would ask each of them is like, so who else should I talk to? Like, you didn't know the answer to this, or you couldn't explain that. Who do you think could? And in that way, the story became this sort of sequence of, you know, tips. Oh, if you want to know really where it began, go talk to Mal Brown. Or if you really want to understand the pathway program that lets a lot of these guys fall off the conveyor belt, well, you need to go speak to Paul Magumbwa. And one after another, they led me through the story.
One of the biggest decisions that a writer has to make is how much of themselves to put in the story, whether to write in the first person or third person. Do you have a rule of thumb as to how much you are in your own stories?
It's a tough one, right? Because I do suspect that there are quite a lot of hard-bitten journos out there that are like, you shouldn't be putting yourself in the story. I understand that point of view, but I just fundamentally don't believe that. And I think it's due to what I came up reading. So I started in newspapers in the US as a features writer, just on daily papers in small towns and medium-sized cities and then bigger cities. But all of that time, I was deeply reading these amazing stories that were written in Esquire and GQ and The New Yorker and all those great magazines. And maybe it's an American thing, but they seemed to have a really rich tradition of writers inserting themselves into the story. And I liked it. I do that quite a bit, and a few of the writers at Good Weekend do as well. And it might just be that it's very different between magazines and daily newspapers. You know, in magazines, I think we're, or at least I am, trying kind of primarily to entertain. I'm not the guy out there writing stuff that's going to spark a royal commission. I'm just trying to get your attention for 35 minutes on a Saturday morning by reading something that you really enjoy.
So there's a story that you did, a profile of tennis player Rod Laver, where you went out and played golf with him. I mean, what do you think that added to the story?
I probably wrote quite a bit of colour into that because he was such a gracious host. Like, we went and hit golf balls at the driving range. We went and had a sandwich together at the local strip mall, sat in his backyard having coffee, drove around his neighbourhood with him complaining about the peacocks and listening to, like, easy listening romantic music. And again, I just think all of that gives you a kind of a peek into who he is and where he is in his life. And that's important for the story, I think, because most of us just don't know. Like, if you just said, what's Rod Laver doing right now? Like, where does he live? What's his life like? You wouldn't have a clue. Like, you'd be able to say something about why he's one of the greats and why he's an icon and when he played his best tennis and how he, you know, was the last male to complete the Grand Slam. But you wouldn't know a thing about his daily life and his struggles and his joys and the things that sustain him. So if you're going to be lucky enough to immerse yourself in those things rather than interviewing him in an office somewhere in some really anodyne setting, it only makes sense to share those details you observe.
And I mean, one piece of advice that writers often give is this idea of killing your darlings. Mm. I've had editors who've taken out what I thought was my best phrase or my favourite parts, and I've been really annoyed. And then it's often sometimes taken years for me to go, actually, you know, the restraint has made it stronger. But how do you decide what to take out, what to leave in, which of the darlings should be let go?
My editor is probably better at that than me. Like, those long 500-word introductions I mentioned, she's quite good at sort of cutting them down to size. And while you see the absence of the darling that you wanted in there in the third line, it's almost impossible to deny that it's better without it, just because it, I don't know, you get wound up in what you think is a really clever or beautiful phrase, and you forget, I guess, the importance of pace. And that's what the editor's probably primarily thinking of. Like, let's just get into this. Like, give the reader as much as you can. Keep them ploughing through. So how do I decide my cuts? There are all sorts of different ways. Like, I wrote a story at the start of last year about a basketball player who came out as gay, and he's still the only professional male basketball player in the world who is out and proud, which is just astonishing in this day and age. Isaac Humphries is his name. And I remember I sat down and wrote the profile, and then I thought, gee, there's a lot of quotes in here. So just as a little experiment, I went through the file and I bolded every single bit of the story that was a quote. And when I panned back from the screen and could look at all 8 pages or whatever on the one screen and just see this sea of bold and black, it was honestly 40% of the story. That is ridiculous. Like, you're the narrator, you're the storyteller. The reader does want to be led through it by you. You might love those quotes, but for a lot of readers, a quote is a speed bump. a quote is something that sort of shakes them out of the narrative that you're trying to draw them into. I've found that killing my darlings most recently involves paring back those quotes. And it takes a bit of a leap of faith because we all have sort of imposter syndrome when we sit down to write and wonder about our voice and whether it's strong enough to draw the reader through. But you really do need to take that responsibility seriously. And so for me, a lot of that comes down to going, he might have said it really well, but you can probably say it better and in fewer words too. And you can keep that pace going.
Yeah, I like that emphasis on pace. I think for me, my darlings, as a news reporter, when I write features and other types of writing, my darlings are often facts. And I find that I just weigh things down with all this detail, which is probably unnecessary in the bigger picture. So I think that emphasis on pace is a really interesting sort of yardstick to use. But when it comes to structure, what else are you looking at?
Well, I'm definitely looking at sentence length. So somebody told me once that long sentences are really good for conveying information and short ones for emotion. There's a really great, just Google, I think it's like this sentence is 5 words long. And it's this beautiful graph that just has a bunch of lines that are all in different sentence length. And it just explains to you how writing comes alive if you vary your sentence length, if you keep people bouncing around. Because if you just have too many of the same size graphs and same size lines one after the other, it becomes this sort of clear monotony in the writing. So I try to punch up writing by doing that. I try to write to the punchline wherever possible. So, you know, section breaks have to end with a little bit of power and perhaps the hint of something to come. So that slight cliffhanger that will keep you going. You try to end quotes on the most powerful word or the most powerful sentiment or the funniest one.
I'm going to ask you now for your two top tips for students in crafting a really engaging feature story.
So the first tip would be around quotes. It was something that I mentioned before that I have only begun learning the importance of, which is quote less, write more. Your readers will thank you. You'll draw them through the story. It's your responsibility. Write more, quote less. And then the other one is a tip that I used to teach journalism students, and it was a commandment that Tom French, a really famous narrative nonfiction writer, Pulitzer Prize winner in America, said at a writer's workshop that I attended a long, long time ago. He had this speech, and it was 10 commandments for great writing. He said, always get the name of the dog, the brand of the beer, and the title of the song that was playing as the car crashed off the road. And I always thought that was just so great because the name of the dog just sort of humanizes the person. The brand of the beer tells you something distinctive about them because there's a very big difference between drinking a Left Blonde and a 4X Gold. And the title of the song that was playing as the car crashed off the road is just a reminder to like search for details that you don't get to see that you weren't there for, but that do exist. They might be very, very hard to get, but God Almighty, if you could get them, like if you were describing that car crash and you knew what song was playing as that person lost control and went over the guardrails, well, wow, what a piece of writing that could be.
And finally, do you have a task for students?
Yeah, well, I think it'd be really beneficial to sit down with a piece of writing that you remember, a feature story that you really enjoyed, but that you're a bit removed from now. Pull it out, print it out, and just highlight things. Highlight all of the quotes in pink highlighter. Highlight all of the pieces of color that are clearly gleaned from observation and sketching things down in a notebook. Highlight those in blue. Highlight transitions in green and just break up a story that way. Try to understand how they built it. And I think if you look at what you see on the page, it'll be really revealing about how to structure a story, at least according to, you know, the writer of a piece that you've enjoyed and maybe you can mimic that style in the future.
That was Conrad Marshall, senior writer for Good Weekend. The Masterclass is produced by Dylan Bird and myself. It's edited by Dylan Bird. Sound design and post-production by John Dia. The original concept is by Anders Furs. Theme tune is by Susie Wilkins. It was partially funded by the GEM Scott Trust. And it's all brought to you by the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne.